Accession number 18498, Real 4.
John Howe, Real 4.
Yeah, I was talking about Mike Wilkins. He became Commandant General in his last tour of the Royal Marines, and in my last tour I was Commandant General of the RAF Regiment. And so we kept loosely in touch from the first day we met. He then went on to be Governor of Guernsey and died last year, I think, or the year before. Time flies so fast these days.
How long were you ashore at Suez 4?
Well, we went ashore. I had some interesting operations with him. And then the ceasefire was called. And the army then started coming ashore, to replace the Royal Marines who went back to Malta. And so there was a garrison there, basically, and I stayed with the garrison until we pulled out of Malta shortly before Christmas in December. We went in on the 6th of November, and then we pulled out just before Christmas. And I was with 3 Brigade then, and I was billeted with the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders.
What were these interesting operations you had with Forty Commander?
Well, one of them was when because the fighting was dying down and they didn't want to cause too much lateral damage, they stopped airstrikes. And so I asked if I could go with a troop that was clearing the customs house in Portside. And the troop was led by Major Pat Wellesley-Wilsey, who became Commandant General at the end of his time in the Royal Marines. But anyway, we went through this place room by room, and there were lots of them. Room by room, room by room. And each one the guys had got out just before we got there. And then we went all the way around, and the last room we came to, there was a wounded Egyptian soldier in there, an officer, and he was terrified because they'd been told we don't take prisoners. Anyway, they tended to him, they tried to calm him, tried to reassure him, and it was extremely difficult. They were terribly kind to him. They summoned, and they had one of these amphibious tracked vehicles, the name of which I forget now, and the young army officer who drove that roared up to come and take him back to the hospital. And because he'd been taking casualties all day, the inside of this particular vehicle was blood spattered. And I'll never forget the troop commander saying, "Wash that all out." And they scrubbed the inside of that thing clean to get rid of all the blood and guts, so that this Egyptian officer would not be frightened anymore. That's the sort of guys they are. And my other experience, involves the French Foreign Legion. And I'm not sure I can talk about it on tape. So if you switch off, I'll tell you, and then you can tell me.
Well, you can tell me later. But any other incidents that you can talk about?
Oh, yes. One morning, just after breakfast, there's a bunch of Fedayeen open fire on us about a block away. And the Royal Marines came charging round. These guys ran out of the building. I think there were four of them. One was shot basically straight away and killed. Two others killed. One was wounded. And they went through the same thing again, where they looked after this guy, gave him a cigarette, chocolate, and tried to cheer him up or ease his fears until the ambulance arrived.
What do you mean by fedayeen?
Fedayeen were the Egyptian, what should we say, infiltrating troops who would get through the lines, I suppose a bit like our SAS, and cause trouble. But it was very interesting with the Royal Marines, very interesting.
So they treated them, their wounded, the same as the Egyptian officer that you described?
Sorry, who treated who?
You said the commanders treated these fedayeen wounded in the same way as they treated them.
Yeah. And the other thing that came to me during this operation is how different to the Korean War. Because people who are not involved in the actual fighting were left alone. I wasn't used to that. You know, anybody who wasn't us was shot or killed or captured or something, but we just never in Korea, if they weren't on your side, you know, they had to be dealt with.
Why should it have been so different?
I don't know. I don't know. I imagine, when I think about it, that the people who were there lived there. There were no sort of reinforcements coming through them. Some of them I saw sitting on balconies watching it all. Most of them, obviously, had pulled the shutters, but you saw the odd person, and obviously a civilian, and they were left alone.
So the Egyptian civilians in the Suez operation had a much better fate than the Korean civilians in the Korean War.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. The other thing, of course, in Korea, I mean, they were, if you found a supply depot in a town or a village, you flattened the supply depot and it didn't matter if there was any other stuff around it. Whereas nothing like that went on in Suez. To my knowledge anyway, I never saw anything that wasn't strictly threatening us attacked.
How do you feel?
Or capable of threatening us, yeah?
How do you feel now in 1998 about having taken part in the Korean War?
Well, I was just over 20. I think I was 21. A lot of the chaps in the South African Air Force were ex-World War II. They were the big boys. I was young. I'd been trained to fight. And I wanted to prove myself. So, I really, really wanted to go. I really wanted to go. And I wanted to fight. And apart from the odd time when I was terrified, I enjoyed it. Which I've now, at my age, I can hardly believe. I loved Suez. I really loved Suez because I just loved being with those Royal Marines. Yeah. Going back to Korea, I was going to tell you in relation to finding people and rescuing them if you possibly can. My great friend, chap by the name of Dennis Earp, who eventually became chief of the South African Air Force. He was on a mission. I was waiting to go on one with my flight, and we were in the ops room. We had radio, so we could listen to what was going on. And I heard that he'd been shot down, and I could hear the RT transmissions. They were losing sight of him. And I was getting very anxious because he was a great friend. And I asked the captain, I was a second lieutenant then. Second lieutenant, I was a flight commander, which will give you some idea of our loss rate. And he said, no, you can't go, you've got to stick to your time. Well, about an hour went by which time they'd lost him. And I really pushed, said I really wanted to go and have a look. And eventually he rang through, and then they said, yes, okay, you can go, but attack your main target first, which I did. And then went to the area to find him, and it was woodland, forest. And I couldn't see where his aeroplane had gone in, and they'd all left, because they couldn't see him anymore. And I was hoping I could pick him up. And I then, a little while later, I was so stupid. You'd have thought by then I'd have known, but I was so stupid. Wanting to sort of look down through the trees, I put my wheels and flaps down. So I would slow down, and I'd put the other guys up much higher. And I'd been sucked into a flak trap, which I was very lucky, because I wasn't blown out of the sky. But I got home, and this also shows our luck thing, because we counted, 40-something holes in my aeroplane, and not one had punctured the glycol line, the coolant. So I got home. Whereas if the tiniest hole had hit that coolant line, I wouldn't. But Dennis was taken a prisoner, and he became a great friend of General Farrar Hockley. They were POWs together.